Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
Okay, today we're tackling a really significant task, laid out right in the title. The federal news update for Friday, September 19th, 2025.
Mm-hmm.
Our aim here is to give you, our listener, a truly comprehensive, really granular, and frankly exhaustive report on these specific high-impact actions, the activities across the entire U.S. federal government that were reported starting early on September 18th, 2025.
Yeah.
And look, this wasn't just another day in Washington. This was a day marked by some pretty aggressive executive action. You had legislative moves aligning with that and some really high-stakes judicial conflicts, conflicts that, you know, actually challenged the fundamental structure of the administrative state.
That's exactly the right way to frame it, because when you pull together all the source material, all the reports from just the single 24-hour window, it's immediately clear this isn't just, you know, a random collection of news items.
Right.
What we're really seeing is the execution of a highly coherent, very unified and, well, aggressive agenda. And it's primarily driven from the executive branch.
Okay.
All these activities, signing major international deals, greenlighting big military sales, pushing through systemic regulatory changes here at home, even initiating these direct legal fights against institutional independence, they all seem to point toward a dual objective.
Okay, and what are those two objectives?
Well, first, it looks like an aggressive push to strengthen America's geopolitical standing and its economic position globally. And it's explicitly framed as competing with rivals.
Mm.
And second, it's about fundamentally transforming the domestic, regulatory, and legal landscape, really trying to centralize executive control and reshape some long-standing institutional norms. We're looking at a government that's actively trying to expand and, you know, consolidate power across pretty much every available avenue.
Okay, quite a setup. Let's unpack this this really significant day. And I think we have to start where that drive, that impetus is most obvious, the executive branch, and specifically its global strategy. The lead story here, and it feels like a major strategic shift, was the US-UK Technology Prosperity Deal, the TPD.
Yeah, this TPD is a big deal, truly landmark. It was signed by President Trump and the UK Prime Minister, Keir Starmer. And it really does fundamentally shift the focus of the US-UK relationship.
How so?
Well, it moves beyond the, you know, the traditional lens of just security and defense cooperation. It puts the focus squarely on three foundational, really 21st century technologies, artificial intelligence, civil nuclear energy, and quantum computing.
Okay.
The language around it is explicit. It's about forging this unified, resilient, transatlantic tech ecosystem specifically designed to counter rising global powers.
And the details on the AI collaboration, they seem particularly specific. It's not just a vague agreement.
Oh, not at all. It sets up deep, practical collaboration on standards between two key institutions, the U.S. Center for AI Standards and Innovation, that's EAISI, and the U.K.'s AI Security Institute, AASI.
Right.
So the idea is to ensure they're aligned on safety benchmarks, how they evaluate AI models, and even exchanging talent. But the real financial muscle, the big investment, comes from this newly announced flagship AI for Science research program.
That sounds ambitious, pulling in resources from multiple U.S. agencies.
It is ambitious. It pools significant funding from the U.S. Departments of Energy and Health and also the National Science Foundation. And the goal isn't just general research. It's very targeted.
Targeted how?
Towards breakthroughs in biotechnology and precision medicine. They're specifically aiming at advances in cancer research and chronic disease treatment. It's really strategic science investment, not just basic research.
So the cooperation is framed around science, but the underlying commercial goal sounds like pure competition. The stated aim is, quote, to offer the global market a full stack of chips, data centers, and models. What exactly does that mean, offering a full stack?
Right. So full stack essentially means providing everything from the foundational components up to the final product or service the user interacts with. In this tech context, especially semiconductors and AI, it implies that this US-UK alliance intends to control or at least strongly influence the entire supply chain. You're talking the chip design, the actual silicon, that's the bottom of the stack. Then the manufacturing facilities, the data centers where AI models are trained and run, that's the middle. And finally, the sophisticated software, the AI models themselves, that's the top of the stack.
Okay, so complete vertical integration, basically.
Exactly. It's a direct competitive play against nations like China. The goal is to ensure that if a country, maybe in Southeast Asia or Africa, wants to build out secure, trusted, kind of democratic aligned technology infrastructure, this Anglo-American stack becomes the go-to, maybe even the only viable, fully integrated option. It's about establishing a dominant global tech paradigm.
And that strategic alignment, you mentioned nuclear energy too, that carries over there, which is inherently geopolitical, isn't it?
Absolutely. The TPD specifically aligns the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the U.K.'s Office for Nuclear Regulation to, well, aggressively streamline the licensing process for new nuclear projects.
Streamline how? Are there specifics?
Yes, they've set some pretty ambitious targets, getting design reviews down to 2 years and site licensing down to just 1 year. If they can actually hit those targets, it would drastically cut the time it takes to deploy new nuclear tech, like maybe small modular reactors, SMRs. That makes nuclear a much more feasible, much faster energy solution.
But the really pointed geopolitical detail seems to be the UK's commitment regarding Russian nuclear fuel.
That's the explicit political signal right there. The UK formally committed to achieving complete independence from Russian nuclear fuel supplies by the end of 2028.
Wow.
This is clear economic statecraft. It's strategic deterrence. It secures a non-Russian fuel supply chain for the UK and firmly aligns them with existing US efforts, statutory commitments even, to reduce reliance on Russian nuclear materials.
So the overall analysis is pretty clear then.
Yeah, the consensus is that this TPD formalizes what they're calling a techno-democratic alliance. And its stated design is explicitly to, quote, beat strategic competitors to market dominance. It's an aggressive, competitive agreement through and through.
And the markets certainly seem to notice immediately. The reports highlight something like $31 billion in new investments announced right away in the UK tech sector. Big names involved too, like NVIDIA, OpenAI, Salesforce, promising tens of thousands of high-skilled jobs.
Yeah, the size of that investment figure, $31 billion, you really can't overstate its significance. It does two things. First, it pumps immediate capital into the UK's tech and science base, sort of validating the TPD's vision right out of the gate.
Mm-hmm.
And second, it effectively locks those major global tech companies into the policy framework the TPD lays out. It makes them stakeholders in this whole techno-democratic agenda. It turns a political agreement into an immediate and potentially stabilizing economic force.
Okay, so shifting gears a bit from that economic statecraft to, well, more traditional hard power projection. The other key foreign policy actions yesterday focused on bolstering security in Eastern Europe and also projecting influence back into Central Asia.
Right. We saw the State Department give the green light to a pretty substantial foreign military sale to Poland. It's valued at $780 million, and it's for Javelin missile systems.
Javelin's okay.
Specifically, 2,506 of the FGM-148F missiles and 253 of the command launch units the CLUs needed to fire them.
And we need to remember the context here, right? This approval comes right after that pretty serious incident where NATO forces had to shoot down, what was it, over 20 Russian drones that violated Polish airspace.
Exactly. That incident really changes the color of this sale. It transforms it from just a routine arms transfer into a very direct, very material reinforcement of the U.S. commitment to Poland as a, quote, key NATO frontline state.
And the Javelin itself is significant.
Tactically very significant. The Javelin is a premier anti-tank weapon system. So by providing this large number of missiles, the U.S. is sending a really clear signal. It's providing an effective deterrent against the primary conventional threat Russia poses to its Western neighbors, which is still, you know, a potential mechanized ground assault. It's deterrence with a very sharp point.
And then, kind of unexpectedly, during that TPD press conference, President Trump brought up the idea of working towards reestablishing a U.S. military presence at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan.
Yeah, that was interesting. And the framing was overtly about great power competition, not really counterterrorism, which was the old justification.
Right.
The president specifically mentioned its value because of its proximity to China, claiming it's, quote, an hour away from where China makes its nuclear weapons. So, rhetorically at least, Bagram was being repositioned as a strategic asset aimed at Beijing.
But the reaction on the ground from Afghanistan itself was pretty swift and negative.
Yes. Almost immediately, a Taliban foreign ministry official dismissed the idea flat out. They pointed to the 2020 Doha agreement, which guaranteed the full withdrawal of all foreign troops.
So not much appetite for a U.S. return there.
It seems not. No. While the administration might be trying to leverage the Taliban's current economic crisis, suggesting, you know, they need international engagement for aid and stability, The Taliban drew a very firm line against any foreign military presence returning. The sources suggest this was probably more about strategic signaling towards China, challenging Beijing's perceived freedom of action in the region, rather than a realistic near-term military goal.
Okay, so let's pivot now from the global stage back to the domestic front. Here, the theme seems to shift pretty dramatically, focusing more on creating systemic friction and centralizing control, starting with what looks like a comprehensive overhaul of the legal immigration system. You called it a coordinated dual strategy.
Exactly. It appears to be a coordinated push across two different agencies, USCIS and the State Department, designed to slow down both the rate of legal immigration itself and the pathway to eventually becoming a U.S. citizen. And they're doing it by raising both the substantive requirements and the procedural hurdles simultaneously.
Okay, let's look at the citizenship path first.
Yeah.
USCIS is rolling out a significantly tougher 2025 naturalization civics test. That goes into effect pretty soon, October 20th.
Yeah, the changes here are quite dramatic, and they're going to impact a lot of long-term legal residents applying for citizenship. First, the pool of potential questions is expanding from 100 up to 128 different subjects.
Okay.
But crucially, the oral exam component is doubling. Applicants will now be asked 20 questions instead of the previous 10.
20 instead of 10? And the passing score.
That's also doubled. You now need to get 12 correct answers instead of just 6.
Wow. Doubling the number of questions and doubling the number needed to pass.
Yeah.
That feels like a very deliberate effort to significantly raise the difficulty bar.
Well, that's certainly the interpretation from immigrant advocacy groups. No. They argue this change really raises the bar substantially, especially for older applicants or maybe those with limited formal education or English language skills. It just makes the journey to citizenship much, much harder.
So a substantive hurdle.
Right. A substantive hurdle seemingly designed to slow down the overall naturalization rate, even for people who've been living here legally following the rules for many years, even decades.
And then at the exact same time, the Department of State announced a new policy that cuts back eligibility for non-immigrant visa interview waivers. That one's effective even sooner, October 1st.
This is the procedural tightening part of the strategy. The practical effect is that it will likely mean mandatory in-person interviews for nearly all non-immigrant visa applicants from now on.
Nearly all, including groups that used to get waivers.
Yes. This now includes categories that were often exempt before based on age, specifically children under 14 and adults over 79. Waivers are being restricted to very narrow cases, like certain diplomats, officials, or some limited visa renewals under very strict conditions.
Okay, so let's connect the dots. If you make the citizenship test much harder to pass, and you introduce massive new procedural hurdles just to get the temporary visa needed to enter the U.S. in the first place, what's the cumulative impact on the whole immigration system?
Well, the cumulative effect looks like systemic blockage. Imposing mandatory in-person interviews almost universally is going to have immediate and quite massive logistical consequences for U.S. consulates around the world.
You mean backlogs?
Huge backlogs. Think month-long waits just for an appointment. Significant processing delays, long queues outside embassies. This is going to disrupt corporate hiring plans, academic exchanges, international travel, project timelines. It functions as a de facto reduction in legal immigration, achieved not through legislation, but through administrative burden. It's consistent with a strategy of just making the whole process slower and more difficult.
All right, shifting now to economic policy, specifically economic control.
Yeah.
We saw this fascinating, almost contradictory situation involving the Federal Reserve, the central bank. On one hand, the White House put out this very triumphant press release titled, "The Economy is Back on Track Under President Trump." Citing things like falling mortgage rates, record stock market highs, rising real wages.
Yeah, pretty standard political messaging, you know, taking credit for any positive economic indicators. But the real story, the institutional battle, was happening simultaneously in the legal arena. The Department of Justice filed an emergency request directly with the Supreme Court. This was in that high-profile case, Trump v. Cook. And they were asking the court for permission to allow the firing of a sitting Federal Reserve Governor, Lisa Cook.
The sources we reviewed describe this as an extraordinary attack on the central bank's independence. Can you remind us why the ability or inability to fire a Fed governor is so fundamental to how the Fed works?
Absolutely. The whole design of the Federal Reserve is meant to insulate it from short-term political pressures. That's why governors serve these long, staggered 14-year terms.
Okay.
And crucially, the law states they can only be removed by the president for cause. Historically, that's been understood to mean things like actual misconduct, malfeasance, or neglect of duty, not just because the president disagrees with their monetary policy decisions.
And that protection is important because...
Because it allows the Fed to make potentially unpopular but necessary long-term decisions, like raising interest rates to control inflation without feeling immediate political retaliation. That independence is vital for maintaining credibility with financial markets, both here and globally, and for ensuring stable economic policy.
So what specifically triggered this direct legal challenge to that independence now?
The source material indicates this legal push came immediately after the Federal Reserve's main policy-setting body, the Open Market Committee, voted to approve an interest rate cut, but it was only a 25 basis point cut. And apparently this was smaller than the president had been publicly demanding. So the administration is now trying to argue that the president's disagreement itself constitutes cause for removal. They're effectively asking the Supreme Court to reinterpret that for cause standard in a way that gives the president much broader authority. This specific provision, the presidential removal power over a Fed governor, has never actually been tested in court in the entire 112-year history of the Fed.
The significance just feels enormous. Legal scholars, quoted in the sources, view this as a very strategic, very calculated move. They see it as an effort to get a landmark Supreme Court ruling that would fundamentally expand presidential power by essentially gutting that for cause protection for leaders of independent agencies.
That's exactly right. It looks like the legal spearhead of a broader ideological project aimed at centralizing control over monetary policy directly under the executive branch. I mean, if the president can fire a Fed governor simply for disagreeing on the size or timing of an interest rate cut, the Fed effectively ceases to be an independent institution.
And the potential consequences.
Immediate risks of higher inflation as markets might anticipate political interference in rate decisions, and potentially a serious erosion of global investor confidence in the stability and predictability of the U.S. economy.
Okay, beyond the Fed, we also saw moves towards centralizing enforcement in other areas. The DOJ and DHS jointly launched a new interagency trade fraud task force.
Yes, and this should be seen as a major signal flare to importers, logistics companies, anyone involved in international trade. The sources describe it as representing a significant escalation in enforcement risk.
How so? What's changing?
Well, historically, customs enforcement often relied more on civil penalties, administrative fines. This new task force signals a distinct shift towards criminal prosecution and seeking maximum penalties. They're actively looking to use tools like the False Claims Act much more aggressively in the trade context.
The False Claims Act. What's the implication of bringing that into customs enforcement?
It's a very powerful tool. The False Claims Act allows the government to sue for treble damages. That's three times the amount of the alleged fraud, plus significant civil penalties per violation. It also has a very strong whistleblower component, which encourages employees or even competitors to report suspected trade fraud.
So it really ramps up the stakes.
Massively. It essentially transforms customs regulation from an administrative process into a highly aggressive punitive tool, seemingly aligned with an America First trade policy agenda. And it centralizes that punitive power more under the Department of Justice rather than just customs officers at the border.
We also saw these centralization efforts playing out at the local level, specifically regarding policing in Washington, D.C. That was the focus of a House oversight hearing yesterday.
Right. That hearing highlighted the intense debate around the recent federal intervention in D.C. policing. The Republican committee chairman praised the unilateral federal action, calling it a resounding success, and pointing to falling violent crime rates as proof.
But D.C. officials disagreed.
Strongly. D.C.'s Attorney General Brian Schwall made a critical counterargument. He warned that this kind of unilateral federal takeover threatens the essential foundation of trust between the community and the police trust that he argued is crucial for effective policing and sustainable crime reduction in the long run.
And there was a significant financial angle to this conflict, too, linking Congress directly to the dispute.
Precisely. The hearing also involved questioning D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser and Council Chair Phil Mendelson about a recent related congressional action.
Right.
Republicans in Congress cut $1.1 billion from D.C.'s local operating budget.
$1.1 billion?
Yeah. And Congressman Lynch, during the hearing, pointed out what he called the severe irony here. You cut a massive chunk, $1.1 billion, of locally raised tax dollars from the city's budget mid-year, making it exponentially harder for the city to deliver basic services, including policing.
Right.
And then the federal government turns around and cites the city's operational struggles, arguably exacerbated by the budget cut, as the justification for seizing federal control over its police department. It really demonstrates a unified strategy, using both direct policy intervention and fiscal leverage to assert top-down federal control over local governance.
That's a really clear through line, and it brings us quite smoothly to the legislative branch itself. It seems while the executive is setting this aggressive tone, Congress, or at least the House, is acting as a pretty strong implementation partner, especially on that energy agenda we touched on earlier.
Absolutely. The House of Representatives definitely spent yesterday laying the statutory groundwork for the administration's energy dominance agenda. And the focus was largely on accelerating energy production by rolling back regulations.
Okay, can you break down the key pieces of that energy legislative package they were debating?
Sure. The House floor took up three main bills. First, there was H.R. 3062, which is called the Promoting Cross-Border Energy Infrastructure Act.
Okay.
This one is designed to streamline the federal permitting process for big international energy projects, think cross-border pipelines carrying oil or gas or major electricity transmission lines. It essentially takes a prior Trump executive order and writes it into permanent law.
So, goal is faster approval for energy infrastructure connecting with Canada or Mexico.
Exactly. Make it faster, less bureaucratic. Second, they debated H.R. 3015, the National Coal Council Reestablishment Act. This does exactly what it sounds like. It brings back this industry advisory body that provides direct input to the Department of Energy, specifically from the coal industry.
A clear signal there.
A very clear signal. It ensures the coal industry has a formal, influential channel right back into federal energy policymaking. It's a reversal of recent trends that sought to diminish the influence of fossil fuel groups.
And the third bill in that package focused on the power grid itself.
Yes, H.R. 2047, called the Grid Power Act. This one grants grid operators, the entities that manage the flow of electricity, new authority to basically expedite the approval process for bringing new power generation projects online faster.
So taken together,
this package represents a really unified three-pronged push. You accelerate the infrastructure build-out with the first bill, you restore industry influence with the second, and you speed up the actual power generation deployment with the third. It's about systematically removing regulatory hurdles at pretty much every stage of the energy supply chain.
Now, despite that unified push on deregulation in energy, there was some friction visible yesterday over workforce issues, specifically provisions tucked into the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA.
Yes, that's an interesting counterpoint. The version of the NDAA that the House has already passed includes a provision aimed at restoring collective bargaining rights for civilian employees within the Department of Defense.
Okay.
And this is explicitly aimed at overturning some anti-union executive orders that were put in place previously by the administration. So it represents a rare instance, maybe, of some bipartisan pushback against the executive's personnel policies.
And we also saw the minority party actively trying to force a vote on a full reversal of those anti-union orders, using a specific procedural tool, a discharge petition. For listeners maybe not deep in the congressional weeds, what exactly is a discharge petition, and why is it significant here?
That's a great question, yeah. A discharge petition is a pretty rarely used but potentially powerful tool in the House. It essentially allows a majority of members, 218 of them, to bypass the normal committee process and even bypass the House leadership, who might be blocking a bill they don't like.
Okay.
If a discharge petition gets enough signatures, it forces that specific bill directly onto the House floor for a vote. In this case, the sources indicate that a separate House bill, one that would fully reverse those anti-union executive orders, only needs two more signatures to reach that magic number of 218.
So it's close.
It's close. And its significance is that it shows the minority is willing to use every procedural lever available to them to challenge the executive's domestic agenda, even when the broader legislative majority in the House seems generally aligned with the administration. It's a way to force uncomfortable votes.
The House also seemed to be using its oversight hearings yesterday, not just for, you know, traditional investigation, but pretty explicitly as platforms to build political support, build a narrative that backs the executive agenda.
Oh, absolutely. The way these hearings are titled and framed is often incredibly revealing, sometimes more so than the actual testimony given.
Right.
For instance, you had the House Homeland Security Committee holding a hearing with the title Invasion of the Homeland, How China is Using Illegal Marijuana to Build a Criminal Network Across America.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that title certainly paints a picture.
It does a lot of heavy lifting, doesn't it? It strategically takes what is, at its root, a complex domestic law enforcement issue, illicit cannabis cultivation, often linked to organized crime, and instantly reframes it as an existential foreign threat, orchestrated by a major strategic rival, China.
Mm-hmm.
This aligns perfectly with those broader foreign policy themes we discussed earlier. The narrative becomes great power competition isn't just happening far away in the South China Sea, it's happening right here on U.S. soil, facilitated by criminal networks, and therefore it justifies aggressive federal action and homeland security resources.
And similarly, the Judiciary Committee held a hearing focused on AI regulation, which seems to tie directly back to that U.S.-UK technology prosperity deal.
Exactly. Their hearing was titled AI at a Crossroads, a Nationwide Strategy or Californication. Yeah. The hearing debated the need for the federal government to preempt or override state-level AI laws. The expert testimony, according to the sources, overwhelmingly argued that a single, unified national framework for AI regulation is essential. They warned against ending up with a regulatory cacophony, basically, a messy patchwork of conflicting rules from different states, like California, which tends to regulate tech more aggressively.
So the push is for one federal standard.
Right. And this push for federal preemption is designed to ensure the U.S. can remain globally competitive in AI and speak with one voice on AI standards, presumably, the same kind of standards they're trying to establish jointly with the U.K. through the TPD. So you see congressional oversight activity directly supporting global strategic objectives.
Meanwhile, over in the Senate, the focus yesterday seemed to be much more on its traditional critical function, personnel management. They confirmed a huge batch of executive and judicial nominations all at once en bloc.
That's right. The Senate confirmed 48 nominations in one single vote as a bloc. It passed on a narrow, strictly party-line vote, 51-47.
And using that en bloc process is significant because?
Because it's the most efficient way to quickly install administration loyalists into key operational roles across the government positions, like assistant secretaries at the Department of Defense or the Department of Energy. It's a procedural tactic that allows the majority party to rapidly put the personnel in place who are needed to actually execute the administration's policy agenda. Speed and efficiency.
And another key action in the Senate yesterday addressed that recurring threat of a potential government shutdown.
Yes, lawmakers reintroduced a bipartisan bill which has strong backing from major military and veterans organizations. It seeks to guarantee that military service members continue to get paid, even if the rest of the federal government shuts down due to a funding lapse.
This is a perennial issue, isn't it?
It is. And while all federal employees are currently guaranteed to receive back pay after a shutdown eventually ends, this bill is about preventing the immediate financial hardship that military families face when their regular paychecks suddenly stop coming.
And the sources highlighted the 2018-2019 shutdown as a key reason why this bill keeps coming back.
Exactly. During that particular shutdown, members of the U.S. Coast Guard actually worked without pay for weeks.
Right, because they fall under DHS, not DOD.
Precisely. The Department of Homeland Security wasn't funded during that shutdown period, while the Department of Defense was. So most other military branches continued to get paid, but the Coast Guard didn't. This bill aims to eliminate that disparity and ensure that all uniformed service members are treated consistently, recognizing their service as essential and something that shouldn't be interrupted by political budget fights.
Okay, let's pivot now to acquisition and contractor accountability. This is a really interesting area where Congress seems to be trying to clamp down on waste, especially after some truly shocking reports from government watchdogs.
Yeah, Congress advanced a new bipartisan bill called the Transparency in Contract Pricing Act of 2025. And it's a direct legislative response to some really egregious examples of overpricing that inspectors general have uncovered.
What are the specific requirements in this bill? What teeth does it have for defense contractors?
It mandates pretty rigorous notification requirements. If a contractor is selling something to the Department of Defense on a sole source basis, meaning they're the only provider they now have, to notify the DOD if the price they're charging increases by more than 25% compared to what they charged on the previous contract or just in the previous year.
Okay, 25%.
And even more strictly, they have to flag it if the price is 50% higher than what the government paid for that same item any time in the last 5 years.
So this is aimed squarely at preventing those kind of headline grabbing, astronomical markups we saw mentioned in the source material.
Yeah.
I mean, the example of the lavatory soap dispenser is almost hard to believe.
It is absolutely wild, isn't it? An inspector general found the Pentagon paid a markup of 7,943% for a simple soap dispenser. 7,943%.
Just incredible.
And while that anecdote is almost comical in its absurdity, it perfectly illustrates the systemic lack of pricing visibility that this new bill is trying to fix. It gives contracting officers the information they need. And the fact that this legislative language is already included in the Senate's version of the 2026 defense policy bill shows it has real momentum and is considered pretty urgent. It's about empowering the Defense Contract Audit Agency to actually crack down on this kind of price gouging.
Okay. Now, at the same time, we also got some very detailed commentary yesterday describing ongoing administrative challenges within the General Services Administration's acquisition process, the GSA, specifically around managing catalogs on the GSA schedule. This sounds like really getting into the weeds of government procurement.
It truly is the trench warfare of government buying. Yeah. But it's important. A former GSA acquisition executive provided this look behind the curtain, explaining why the process remains so incredibly frustrating for the companies, the vendors, trying to sell to the government through GSA.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, catalog management, just the basic task of getting a product added to your GSA contract or updating the price, is still a monumental administrative hurdle. And it undermines the very efficiency and ease of use that the GSA schedule program is supposed to provide.
What are the specific roadblocks? What makes it so hard for vendors?
Well, this former executive highlighted two major recurring problems. First, sometimes the inflexible demands of individual contracting officers. For example, some officers apparently will only accept copies of recent commercial invoices to prove that a vendor's proposed price is fair and reasonable.
Even if the price seems obviously fair.
Even if the vendor's proposed price is clearly competitive, maybe even lower than the average price already listed for similar items right there on GSA Advantage, the online portal. This rigid insistence on only one type of paper proof, invoices, makes pricing unnecessarily difficult and slow.
And the automated systems, the technology, isn't helping either.
Exactly the second point. The automated system GSA uses, called 4P, it's an algorithmic tool meant to evaluate proposed prices against existing market data, is apparently malfunctioning pretty regularly.
How so?
It keeps spitting out no market research found determinations, even for common items that are clearly available from numerous contractors already on GSA Advantage. When that happens, it just stops the approval process dead in its tracks. The system that's supposed to ensure the government gets a fair price is actually creating administrative gridlock when it breaks down.
And this systemic inflexibility, this technological friction, is actually leading vendors to find workarounds that, in the end, damage the integrity of the government's own pricing data.
Precisely. To get around this broken 4P algorithm, frustrated vendors apparently sometimes resort to slightly altering the manufacturer's part number for their product.
Why would they do that?
To make their item appear new to the system, thus bypassing the faulty pricing comparison check altogether. But the cumulative effect of thousands of vendors doing this contributes to the absolutely unmanageable number of items, the source mentioned 100 million items, listed on GSA Advantage. And it fundamentally erodes the reliability of the very pricing data that contracting officers need to make smart purchasing decisions. It becomes this vicious cycle. Administrative failure drives data corruption, which makes administration even harder.
And now there's potentially new complexity coming down the pike with a recently introduced economic price adjustment clause, the EPA clause, which is meant to help vendors deal with inflation.
Yeah, this new clause, while probably necessary in an inflationary environment, carries a significant risk of becoming an administrative nightmare. And that's because the specific timing and the methods for calculating these price adjustments are apparently being individually negotiated with each contractor for each contract.
So no standardization at all.
Apparently not, or very little. Imagine you're a GSA contracting officer managing, say, 50 different contracts. Under this new system, one contract might allow price adjustments based on changes in the Consumer Price Index, CPI, but only annually. Another might be tied to a specific producer price index, PPI, for, say, raw steel, adjusted quarterly. A third might use a different index altogether and only allow adjustments every 18 months.
That sounds incredibly complex to manage.
It forces the federal acquisition workforce, which everyone agrees is already stretched incredibly thin, to track and manage maybe dozens of unique price adjustment methodologies. It turns basic price management into this unscalable, incredibly burdensome administrative task that just eats up time and introduces huge potential for errors.
So what's the proposed solution from this expert? Is there a better way?
The recommendation was pretty fundamental. Transition away from vendor-managed catalogs towards a curated, centrally GSA-managed catalog.
GSA manages it, not the contractor.
Right. The argument is that GSA, as the program manager, should set the standard framework. This would ensure that all products meet policy requirements from the start. It would allow for standardization of products and pricing where appropriate. And critically, it would allow GSA to standardize the EPA methods, the timing, the thresholds across contracts.
What would be the benefit?
It would offer predictability for industry because everyone knows the rules.
Mm-hmm.
And it would drastically reduce the administrative workload on the individual contracting officers, freeing them up to focus on more strategic aspects of procurement rather than just wrestling with bureaucratic complexity and broken algorithms.
Okay. Now we need to transition to the final major battleground we saw activity in yesterday, the judicial branch. This seems to be where the rubber really meets the road, where the executive's agenda is running head-on into existing institutional guardrails.
Yeah, this is absolutely the arena where the structural integrity of the administrative state itself is being directly tested. And we have to start with what looks like a coordinated assault on the independence of regulatory agencies, specifically focusing yesterday on the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB.
There was a major ruling from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in that high-profile SpaceX case directly challenging the NLRB structure. What was the core of that ruling regarding the separation of powers?
The Fifth Circuit panel ruled that these statutory protections, the laws passed by Congress that shield NLRB board members and its administrative law judges from being fired by the president except for cause, are likely unconstitutional.
Why?
They argued these protections violate the separation of powers doctrine. Essentially, the court said Congress overstepped its bounds and unconstitutionally tied the president's hands by limiting his ability to remove these officials only for reasons like misconduct or neglect of duty, rather than allowing removal at will.
Okay, what's the practical immediate impact of that ruling, especially for employers and workers within the Fifth Circuit's jurisdiction?
Well, the sources describe it as a huge blow to the NLRB's enforcement ability in that region. Because the court found that the employer, SpaceX in this case, was likely to ultimately succeed on its constitutional claim, it opens the door for employers to get injunctions from federal courts.
Injunctions that do what?
That halts the NLRB's prosecution of unfair labor practice cases against them. So this means powerful, well-resourced employers in the Fifth Circuit, which covers Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi, can now potentially just run to court, get an injunction based on this precedent, and effectively stop the NLRB from enforcing workers' rights to organize and bargain collectively in that entire very large region.
And this ruling, this line of argument, it potentially challenges the fundamental structure of many independent agencies across the federal government, right? Not just the NLRB.
Absolutely. The whole point of creating agencies like the Federal Reserve, the NLRB, the Federal Trade Commission, was to have bodies that could make expert, fact-based decisions in the long-term public interest, insulated from the immediate winds of short-term political influence. This ruling directly attacks that core principle of institutional insulation. It really opens the door to broader, more systematic legal challenges targeting the legitimacy of the entire administrative state as we know it.
Which brings us right back, full circle, to that case we discussed earlier involving Federal Reserve independence.
Yeah.
Trump v. Cook.
Exactly. That emergency request filed by the administration asking the Supreme Court to lift a lower court's injunction and allow the president to fire Governor Lisa Cook. It needs to be seen in this broader context. It looks deeply strategic. It seems calculated to try and secure a sweeping landmark precedent from the Supreme Court itself, a precedent that would significantly expand presidential removal authority over the leaders of independent agencies. This aligns perfectly with the ideological project we see targeting the NLRB. The goal appears to be gutting that for cause protection across the board and centralizing executive control over functions like monetary policy or labor relations that were deliberately designed to be non-political.
The judiciary also generated significant turmoil yesterday in the immigration sphere, resulting in what's called a direct circuit split on the legality of certain humanitarian immigration programs.
Yeah, we saw two federal appellate courts issue completely contradictory rulings on essentially the same day regarding the executive branch's authority to end or roll back humanitarian protections for certain groups.
What were the conflicting rulings?
On one hand, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals at West rejected the administration's attempt to terminate temporary protected status, or TPS, for Venezuelans currently in the U.S. The court found the administration likely didn't follow the proper procedures or have the statutory authority to end TPS in that specific manner.
Okay, so the Ninth Circuit said the administration couldn't end it. But the First Circuit?
The First Circuit, based in Boston, ruled essentially the opposite way on a similar related policy. They decided that the administration does have the legal authority to end humanitarian parole protections for migrants who had come from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela under a specific parole program.
So one court says yes, one court says no on similar administration actions.
Yeah.
That creates a direct conflict.
A direct, immediate contradiction between two different federal circuits. This is what lawyers call a circuit split. And it instantly creates nationwide legal chaos and uncertainty.
What's the ultimate consequence of that judicial chaos for, say, the immigrants affected or for the system overall?
Well, legally, a circuit split makes it much more likely that the Supreme Court will have to step in and resolve the contradiction eventually. But in the meantime, it creates massive uncertainty and anxiety for hundreds of thousands of immigrants whose status is now in legal limbo.
Mm-hmm.
And while this confusion sows fear and kind of paralyzes those communities, some legal analysts quoted in sources suggest this administrative and judicial uncertainty might perhaps inadvertently serve the administration's broader policy objective.
Which is?
Deterring legal immigration simply by making the system chaotic, unpredictable, and ambiguous. In effect, the judicial complexity itself becomes a kind of strategic tool, intentional or not, that discourages people from navigating the legal pathways.
Okay. Finally, we need to touch on some important financial and personnel updates that directly affect the federal workforce itself, the people who actually make this whole system run.
Right. A couple of key data points on the financial side. First, the baseline expectation is that most federal employees are currently projected to get a fairly standard 1% pay raise in the 2026 fiscal year. Second, reflecting ongoing budget pressures, the Office of Personnel Management, OPM, has apparently put a pause on most employee relocations, citing significant costs. This could make it harder for agencies to strategically move staff to where they're needed most.
But perhaps the most significant workforce news yesterday, impacting retention for a really critical group, came from the Department of Veterans Affairs, the VA. It concerns their use of special salary rates, or SSRs.
Yes. The VA announced it plans to end the special salary rate it had implemented for its crucial IT workforce. This covers positions like IT management, the 2210 job series, computer engineers, Ariat 854s, and computer scientists, 1550s.
And this SSR was important.
Very important for recruitment and retention. It was implemented back in 2023 and provided an average pay increase of about 17% for roughly 7,000 VA tech workers. The sources say it dramatically improved the VA's ability to hire and keep these highly sought-after tech professionals.
Ending a 17% pay bump for IT staff.
Yeah.
That sounds like a huge step backward, especially given how hard the federal government typically finds it to compete with the private sector for top tech talent.
It certainly appears to be a potentially devastating blow to retention efforts, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The source material notes the VA had actually managed to aggressively hire about 1,000 new IT workers using this 17% pay boost as a key incentive.
Right.
And now canceling that SSR aligns directly with the administration's proposed fiscal 2026 budget request for the VA, which reportedly aims to shrink the VA's Office of Information and Technology workforce by cutting about 1,000 IT expert positions.
So they're cutting the pay incentive and planning to cut the number of jobs.
It looks like a double whammy. The policy seems to be simultaneously removing the financial incentive that helped attract and retain talent, while also aiming to reduce the overall size of that specialized workforce. It seems likely to accelerate attrition in precisely the job categories that are hardest to fill and most critical for modernization.
Okay, now let's look at one last area. The critical infrastructure and cybersecurity realm. The sources revealed what seems like a really severe funding paradox buried within the details of the July budget reconciliation bill.
Yeah, this is a classic and potentially dangerous offense versus defense dichotomy that seems to create significant national risk. On one hand, that bill allocated a substantial amount, $1 billion over 4 years, specifically for U.S. offensive cyber operations.
Offensive cyber ops.
Right. With a particular focus on U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, presumably aimed at strategic rivals like China or Russia.
Okay, so investing in offense. But at the same time, defensive capabilities were cut.
That's the paradox and the danger. The same bill cut $1.2 billion from civilian cyber defense programs. These cuts impact the very agencies responsible for protecting U.S. critical infrastructure agencies, like CISA, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, NIST, which set cybersecurity standards, and the National Science Foundation, which funds research. And this funding cut comes at a time when CISA's own headcount its number of employees, has already reportedly been reduced by over 1,000 people in recent times.
So you increase spending to go on the attack in cyberspace, but you simultaneously cut funding and personnel for the agency supposed to defend the homeland from cyber attacks.
That's exactly the situation it creates. You significantly enhance your offensive cyber posture, making you a more threatening actor on the global stage, but you simultaneously diminish your capacity to defend against the inevitable retaliatory cyber attacks that enhanced offense is likely to provoke.
And this disparity, more offense, less defense, creates a massive and pretty explicit risk, especially for the private sector, right? Since they own and operate most critical infrastructure.
The risk is significantly heightened exposure to sophisticated, potentially destructive, state-sponsored retaliatory cyber attacks. If the U.S. government is openly signaling and funding more aggressive offensive cyber operations against major nation states, you have to assume those adversaries will escalate the frequency, sophistication, and potentially the severity of their counterattacks.
And the targets will be.
Likely, U.S. critical infrastructure, which is, as you said, predominantly owned and operated by the private sector. Think energy grids, water systems, hospitals, financial networks, and CISA, the very agency tasked with coordinating the defense of that infrastructure, now apparently has fewer people and less money to do its job right when the threat level might be increasing.
So given that paradox, what are the immediate practical takeaways? What are the recommendations coming from industry experts for private sector companies, especially government contractors, right now?
While cybersecurity experts quoted in the sources are urging immediate aggressive shifts towards a more defensive posture, first, companies absolutely must work to reduce their supply chain exposure.
Why the focus on supply chains?
Because supply chains are consistently one of the easiest vectors for sophisticated attackers to gain access. This means companies need to conduct rigorous due diligence on all their third-party vendors and build strong cybersecurity requirements into their contracts.
Okay. What else?
Second, they need to dust off their incident response plans or create them if they don't have them and practice them relentlessly. Tabletop exercises, simulations. They need clear, tested escalation procedures that assume they might be dealing with a nation-state level adversary, not just common cyber criminals.
And the human element remains critical, especially with threats like AI-enhanced phishing.
Absolutely paramount. Companies need to invest continuously in workforce training and awareness. AI is making social engineering attacks like phishing emails or deepfake voice calls incredibly personalized, sophisticated, and very hard for employees to spot. Training has to keep pace. And finally, accountability for basic cyber hygiene like patch management needs to be crystal clear and centralized. Nation-state hackers love exploiting known vulnerabilities, including zero days. Companies need robust mechanisms to identify critical patches and deploy them immediately, often within hours, not days or weeks, as soon as a fix becomes available. There's just no room for delay when facing these kinds of threats.
This has been an incredibly detailed, really granular look at the concentrated federal activity just from September 18th. Let's try to synthesize the key takeaways from this deep dive.
Yeah, when you step back and look at the whole picture from that single day, it really is one of comprehensive executive assertion of power. Globally, you saw significant strategic and economic realignment epitomized by that US-UK tech deal, explicitly aimed at establishing dominance over geopolitical rivals.
Mm-hmm.
And then domestically, there was this concerted, seemingly coordinated push to override traditional institutional checks and constraints. That was visible in the aggressive overhaul of immigration rules, and maybe most critically, in those direct, arguably historic legal challenges to the independence of the Federal Reserve and the basic structure of the administrative state via the NLRB case.
And Congress wasn't just watching from the sidelines. The House, in particular, seemed to be acting as a powerful implementation partner for the executive agenda, pushing deregulation, like the energy bills, and using its oversight platforms to reinforce the administration's political narrative.
Exactly. And that leaves the judiciary as the main point of immediate friction. The court system is now clearly the primary arena where the legality, the constitutionality of these executive power plays is being fought out, from the NLRB's structure to the Fed governor's removal authority to the whole shifting landscape of immigration law. It's all heading towards emergency Supreme Court filings and these messy circuit splits.
So for you, the informed observer trying to track the real machinery of Washington, perhaps those profound developments we saw on September 18th were those systematic attempts to centralize presidential control over domains that were traditionally designed to be independent things like monetary policy, labor relations, the insulated administrative state.
And that leads us directly to the final, maybe provocative thought we want to leave you with today. We saw these major historical friction points. The independence of the Fed, the structure of the NLRB come under direct, calculated legal assault, all reported on the same day. The key question for all of us going forward isn't just what specific policies were advanced or blocked yesterday. It's perhaps a more fundamental question.
Sure.
Can the legal and constitutional guardrails that have been established over the last century, guardrails specifically designed to insulate critical long-term decision-making from the turbulence of short-term political change, can they actually withstand this highly systematic multi-front effort to fundamentally rewrite the rules of government independence and presidential power? That legal battle, that structural conflict, feels like it will define the next chapter.
An absolutely essential question, and one we'll obviously need to continue monitoring closely. Thank you for guiding us through this incredibly crucial deep dive.
Always a pleasure. Good talking with you.